Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Available on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.
Charlie, what you've done is incredible here.
Maybe Charlie Kirk is on the college campus.
I want you to know we are lucky to have Charlie Kirk.
Charlie Kirk's running the White House, folks.
I want to thank Charlie. He's an incredible guy. His spirit, his love of this country. He's done an amazing job building one of the most powerful youth organizations ever created, Turning Point USA.
We will not embrace the ideas that have destroyed countries, destroyed lives, and we are going to fight for freedom on campuses across the country. That's why we are here.
Today on the Charlie Kirk Show, we analyze the flawed and racist prism through which the left views America as nothing more than a brutal and cruel dynamic of oppressor versus oppressed, and how they plan to weaponize this narrative to fundamentally transform and deconstruct the greatest nation and the greatest economy in the history of the world. This is Charlie Kirk, host of the Charlie Kirk Show, your home of rational, conservative, and libertarian thinking. Before we go any further, please press subscribe, give us that 5-star rating, and please get a friend to do the same. It helps us out a lot. Buckle up. Here we go. Are we ready for some football? Oh my goodness, am I ready for some football? Woo! Okay, here we go. This weekend, I would love to be at this game, but I'm not going to this game because my very good friend Candace Owens is getting married. Congratulations, Candace. On behalf of the Charlie Kirk Show and everyone at Turning Point USA, we are so proud of you and George. I can't wait to be there. But if I wasn't at Candace Owens' wedding, I would be at the Oregon versus Auburn football game. My dad, my uncle and my aunt all went to the University of Oregon. We are huge Duck fans. Ducks are the underdog. I'm doing like quotes, underdog. Yeah, okay, sure. I think they actually are a great bet. Well, speaking of betting, if you want to make a bet and you think you know what you're talking about with sports, like I pretend to do on this show, there's only one place then to place your bet. That's betonline.ag. You go up, you sign up today for a free account, and you use that promo code PODCAST1. College football is one of the most beautiful things ever created. It's like watching Picasso with whistles. It's amazing. I just love seeing it in real time. It's extraordinary. It's one of the most amazing American institutions, especially the first couple weeks. Every team is so fired up, all that pent-up energy. And all of you listening to this, I know we got a lot of sports fans out there. I get a lot of messages. You got to go to betonline.ag. BetOnline.ag, use that promo code PODCAST1, receive a 50% welcome bonus. Look, we got college football, there's NFL preseason, Major League Baseball, but of course, college football is why all of you actually watch sports, because that's the thing to do. Go right now to BetOnline.ag, use that promo code PODCAST1, and the Cubs are going to win the World Series. If you disagree, then bet on it. BetOnline.ag, use that promo code PODCAST1. All right, everybody, welcome to this episode of the Charlie Kirk Show. As we talked about in the prior episode, we are just beginning to dive in to our persistent pursuit of trying to figure out the American left. And this is so important because instead of just getting into the horse race of Biden versus Warren versus Sanders, which we do here on the Charlie Kirk Show, instead of just talking about all the gaffes that Joe Biden is making, and there are quite a plenty of them. I mean, Joe Biden doesn't know what state he's in at times. He doesn't know how to correctly ask people to text into his campaign. There's plenty of gaffes with Joe Biden. We like to go a layer deeper, and the feedback we've been getting at the Charlie Kirk Show of going a layer deeper, talking about the philosophy, talking about economics, talking about what actually motivates the left, has really just, it's helped us surge in the charts, and we are just getting such unbelievable feedback. And the reason we do this is that if you understand the American left, you can predict what they're going to do next, and you can be a better activist, a better voter, and a better citizen of the country. And you can better understand the news media, what they're telling you, why they're telling it to you, and understand the goals and the needs, the wants of the Democrat Party. And so in the prior episode, we talked about kind of where the left does not have guardrails. So I really kind of want to build this out. So for those of us that are conservative libertarians, I'm one myself, I'm a conservatarian. So I blend the word conservative and libertarian together. I believe three really, really big things politically and patriotically. Number one, I believe America is the greatest country ever to exist in the history of the world. Number two, I believe the Constitution is the greatest political document ever written. And number three, I believe free enterprise capitalism is the most moral, proven, and effective economic system ever discovered. I believe firmly in John Locke's ideas, which were taken straight from Aristotle, the idea that the individual matters, that the individual is sovereign, that the collective is nothing more than individuals voluntarily putting themselves into something bigger than themselves. This is so important because the left does not believe this. I'm going to tell you exactly philosophically what the left believes and really why they believe it. But the first thing that we must admit, the first thing that we must come from is you, the person that's listening to this podcast. If you're listening to this, you are sovereign. Your decisions matter. Your thoughts matter. And most important, more than anything else, you have natural rights upon your birth. You have the right to your life. Of course, I wonder where we've heard that before. You have a right to your thoughts, a right to your consciousness, a right to your creativity. And what has made Western civilization so successful and so unique and so special is that it's been the protection of those rights against government and against other people possibly intruding upon those rights. And we believe that these are endowed by your creator. So we believe that God, or a God, if you will, gave you these rights. So in man's natural state of being, that these rights were given to you irregardless of government. And so if someone in the middle of nowhere is born on an island 500 miles off the coast of California, does he still have natural rights? And the answer is, of course. He has the right to his own consciousness. He has the right to his own dreams, his own ambitions. Now, those dreams and ambitions might be much more simple on that island where he might be all alone than if he was in California. But the individual, his humanity is not any less just because there's not a government superstructure built above him. So government is us consenting and giving up some of those freedoms and giving up some of those liberties, understanding that there has to be some form of an independent structure that can adjudicate our differences and enforce the rule of law. And so let's just start in a very concrete example, something very important that kind of really frustrated me and ticked me off. On Twitter the other day, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, I love just saying her name, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, she tweeted out, and Mr. Producer will pull up the tweet right now, and I had a response to it. She essentially said something along the lines of that Republicans are trying to lead us to believe that we are not a democracy. And I read this, I said, well, she's right, we aren't a democracy. We're not. So this is what AOC actually said, quote, she said, well, it's official. Republicans are now arguing that the U.S. isn't, parenthesis, and shouldn't be a democracy. This is what they believe. From lobbyists writing their bills to sabotaging our civil rights, the GOP works to end democracy. In reality, we have to grow it. Boy, is this an important point. And so if you actually look at where the idea of democracy comes from, democracy has been tried many, many times over many thousands of years. Republics have not always been tried, especially a republic based in a constitution that recognizes the rights of the individuals. That has not been tried. In fact, it was such an unbelievable giant leap forward that John Locke, right around the early 1700s, came out of nowhere. John Locke came out of absolutely nowhere and articulated the ideas of the sovereign individual, where he challenged the premise that your whole identity is based in group identity. He challenged the premise in an autocratic ruler. Now, mind you, even you look at Hobbes, who I agree with Hobbes. And for those of you who don't know who Hobbes is, he had a very brutish, one would say, observation of human nature. He came right before Locke. Hobbes talked about he grew up under essentially a civil war, and he was actually born early. Here's a fun fact. Hobbes was actually born early because his mother went into labor because she was so afraid of the Spanish Armada that was coming. And so Hobbes had a very brutal and I think at times accurate observation of human behavior. He believed human beings were self-interested, nasty, and Hobbes argued that the only type of government that could possibly control these self-interested, savage humans would be an autocratic dictator. He said that's the only form of government. And guess what? Hobbes was really wrong about that, but he was really right about self-interested human beings. So John Locke didn't necessarily disagree with Hobbes when it came to his observation of humans, that in the natural state, in nature, human beings will serve their own self-interest. John Locke said, but that doesn't necessarily mean you have to give up your rights of the, your rights and your wants and your freedoms. What if there was another way to do this? What if there was a way to protect that of which is given to you in nature and try to incentivize virtue? And understand that human beings are broken by nature, and this comes from the Judeo-Christian idea of original sin, but instead try to create a construct of some sort where the best parts of humanity are essentially reinforced and the negatives are prevented from that government structure. What John Locke did was the Great Leap Forward. You've heard about the Great Leap Forward before in many different contexts. This was the actual Great Leap Forward. And you kind of heard of Silicon Valley. This was Enlightenment Scottish Valley. What do you mean? What is the comparison? Well, what happens in Silicon Valley is you have all these entrepreneurs that are clustered together and they share their best ideas and they come up with the most amazing innovations, the semiconductor, the internet. The same could be said for what happened in Scotland when you had John Locke, Hume, and Adam Smith, where they were all experimenting with these ideas. And they were experimenting, well, what if human beings actually could be free? This was so radical. And honestly, it was untested. It was totally and completely untested. And do you know who was a huge fan of John Locke? Who was a massive fan of John Locke? Thomas Jefferson. Thomas Jefferson thought John Locke was just one of the most amazing thinkers, and he said this, human beings could do this. And John Locke also talked about that human beings have an obligation to rebel against an autocratic leader or dictator if they become oppressive. I would make the argument that without John Locke, the American founding would never have happened. The American Revolution might have happened. They might have rebelled against the British rulers. However, but forming America, where you actually recognize the natural rights of your life, of your speech, of your consciousness, the right to own property, the right to pursue happiness, and the right to keep government out of your life, there is no guarantee that that would have happened whatsoever. And so if you look at the American founding and the ideas behind the American founding, it was the first time that victors, essentially political winners of a conflict, actually voluntarily gave up their political power. They could have had the Jeffersonian, Madison, Washington ruling class and divided the American states into essentially little city states, and they could have been kings and they could have been queens and they could have been autocrats for a long time. But instead, they embrace this idea of government that is limited, not a democracy. This is so important. The words democracy are not put anywhere in the Bill of Rights. They just aren't. And people say, oh, we're a democracy. We are not a democracy. I'm going to tell you the big difference. I'm going to walk you through exactly what that means. And I'm going to tie you into what the left is trying to create here into this country. And simultaneously, while all of this was happening, as the American founding was occurring, a little bit after that, you had the French Revolution, which had fundamentally different ideas than the American Revolution. Instead of recognizing the idea of the individual being sovereign, to be able to speak, to be able to create, to be responsible for oneself, this is so important that essentially, yes, you can go start a business, you can go west, you can take a risk. However, if you don't succeed, it's up to you. You must be self-reliant. And if you don't succeed, don't look to the government. Look to the church. Look to this local community. Look to each other. Look to your neighbor. Don't look to government to try to be the most important thing when things don't go according to your plan. Now, you juxtapose that and contrast that with the French Revolution. The French Revolution was much more about the collective. Now, the collective is a nice way to essentially describe the mob. Now, the founding fathers were so fearful of the potential mob rule that they put so many different measures into our Constitution. They put so many different measures within the founding of our country to prevent the mob from potentially getting too angry and having too much angst to overthrow good ideas, to overthrow natural rights, just because 50, 60, 70% of people thought it should happen. The French Revolution was completely different. The French Revolution was a bunch of narcissistic, self-interested, politically hungry individuals that wanted nothing more than to overthrow the ruling class. And that's exactly what they did. Did you know in the French Revolution, they actually restarted time? Did you know in the French Revolution that they actually started time over in the year 1792? They wanted to delete all history before it. In fact, I had a really good exchange with Senator Rand Paul. And for those of you that have not heard my podcast with Senator Rand Paul, please go back in the Charlie Kirk Library, download it, and listen to it. Let's play a short clip where I talk about this sort of very important philosophy with probably my favorite U.S. Senator, Senator Rand Paul.
It's a good point with Rousseau because you either get your rights natural and they're yours and you own them. They're intrinsically, they're inherent to you, or the majority gives them to you. And so Rousseau was a big believer in democracy. But here's the problem with democracy. And anytime people tell you, oh, we're going to go to war for democracy and all this, remind them, we're not a democracy, we're a republic. And also remind them that there have been times when the majority does the wrong thing. And I'll give you a couple of examples. The Jim Crow laws. They were passed by majorities in the South. And don't let them tell you it was Republicans. They were all Democrats, every damn one of them. But they made these laws because they believed that the majority, the power of the majority, could run roughshod over a minority. And there's a great line in Martin Luther King's A Letter from the Birmingham Jail where he says that an unjust law is a law where the numerical majority imposes something on the minority but does not make it binding on themselves. And that's sort of the definition of a bad law. It has to apply to everybody equally. You can't say it was a law for whites and a law for blacks. But Martin Luther King got it. But we need to be reminded that majorities are not always right, and you don't want a majority taking away your right to own a gun or where you go to church or who you associate with.
And so going to the American founding was about liberating individuals. Now, and I've said this before on this program, and I'll say it again, that the founding fathers did not live up to their own ideals upon the American founding as well as they should have. The American founding, unfortunately, consisted of individuals that owned slaves. But that didn't mean their ideas are any less valid today than they were back then. The Constitution was not written for the times. It was written to stand the test of time. And this is really important because despite the United States Constitution allowing slavery, it also allowed for slavery to be abolished. That's what was one of the brilliant measures within the United States Constitution is the ability to amend and to correct mistakes that might have been made previously. And so it was about liberation. And a year after the Declaration of Independence, interestingly enough, the state, not the Constitution, but after the Declaration, the state of Vermont abolished slavery. And so if you want to look at actually all these ideas coming together, there was a bubbling up of freedom that started in the late 1600s that climaxed into the 1770s. And it is inarguable that the ideas within the American founding, the ideas of free enterprise to the individual liberty of free speech has resulted into the greatest human rights project in the history of the world. And I just have to tell you, I'm spending this beginning portion of the Charlie Kirk Show intentionally because I am getting messages after messages of kids in classrooms that are being taught this garbage from the New York Times, the 1619 Project. We did a whole show on this before. And to reinforce some of the themes we said earlier, is essentially the New York Times is trying to make the argument that you cannot understand American history unless the true founding of our country was in 1619. Now, according to them, the significance of the year 1619 is when the first slaves were brought into America. Despite America not actually existing as a country at the time, despite it actually being British colonies, despite it being the British slave trade, the left wants to reshape our history similar to how the French revolutionaries wanted to reshape history in year 1792 and get rid of the Gregorian calendar and go to their own French calendar, the same way they wanted to rewrite history before that, the same way that the Chinese Cultural Revolution communists wanted to destroy all the statues and rewrite history there, the same way the American left is trying to say that we were founded on racism. Robert Francis O'Rourke, the Irishman who uses a Spanish name from El Paso, said this, quote, "This country, though we like to think otherwise, was founded on racism, has persisted through racism, and is racist today." We were not founded on racism. We were founded on liberty. Did any of the American founders rebel against the British Empire to try to keep their slaves or to, under the guise of slavery, Of course not. They rebelled because of tyrannical rule. Now, mind you, some of them did not live up to these very ideals that we talk about today. We had to fight a very bloody civil war where hundreds of thousands of people died to eradicate slavery. And it took a remarkable amount of courage from Republicans to eradicate slavery. However, to say that we were founded on racism is one of the most inaccurate and demagoguery-filled statements that I've heard from a leftist running for political office in quite some time. Robert Francis O'Rourke, we're not founded on racism. We were founded during a time where there was some racism. And guess what? There is still some racism today. However, we were also founded on a country, under an idea that has been replicated, duplicated, and perfected over the last 180 and 200 years. And what Robert Francis O'Rourke, who calls himself Beto, what he's really trying to say here is he's trying to cheapen the ideals, cheapen the foundational pride that we have in this country that allowed the greatest experiment ever to exist in the history of the world. Pete Buttigieg, the failed mayor from South Bend, Indiana, said the following. He said, "We are by no means even halfway done dealing with systemic racism in this country. And I hope over the course of this campaign, you will see how I speak about these issues, not only with mostly black audience, but mostly white audiences. Despite having no data, no evidence, and no facts to actually back up this myth, this lie, and this falsehood of systemic racism, they just continue to push this forward." And so if you actually look at the left, and this is really important, the left wants, in some ways, some equality of outcome. Some equality of outcome. Think about what I'm saying there. In some ways, the left does not want hierarchies. The left has a highly Marxist and somewhat Rousseauian view of human nature, that what makes us flawed, what makes us self-interested, what makes us greedy, what makes us sinful is not the individual itself, as Hobbes would argue. It was not the individual, but instead it's the system. Instead, it's the system. And most specifically, if you want to go all the way back to where these ideas were first debated and these ideas were first kind of put head to head, it's this one central issue. The issue of private property. Should individuals be able to own private property? It's really this simple. Well, I shouldn't say it's that simple, but I'm making it this simple for you. There's so many other complex, deeper layers, but I'm going to make it as simple as this because it really boils down to this. Should individuals be able to own private property? How much should they be able to own? And what system should they be able to own it? Do you know who disagreed about this vehemently, who had totally differing opinions on this? Plato and Aristotle, 2,000 years ago. Plato in the Republic argued that the abolition of private property was necessary through essentially creating a form of utopia, essentially to create something better. Aristotle disagreed completely and fundamentally. He believed that private property was critical and essential towards individuals being able to amass their own private wealth, their own success, and be able to actually have some sort of have the nuclear family intact. Plato actually also believed in breaking apart the nuclear family. And so you look at the idea of private property has been hotly debated for thousands and thousands of years, 2,000 plus years, I should say. You go fast forward all the way to Marx. Marx also believed that the idea and the ownership of private property was highly flawed. So, same with Rousseau. And talking about should individuals be able to own private property, and if they own private property, what should the way they should be able to own it? And this is so important because Adam Smith, the discoverer of the free market, very important. No one created the free market. Somebody created communism. No one created the free enterprise system. Now, mind you, I try not to use capitalism because capitalism is actually a Marxist term. It's created by Marx. What did I just say? I just said that no one created free enterprise. That's right. Because free enterprise is natural. People have been engaging in the market for thousands and thousands of years. In order for people to engage in communism or socialism, it's man-made. It's created. It has to be theorized, articulated, and implemented. People left to their own devices, they're going to barter, they're going to trade, they're going to interact, they're going to create. If there is no playbook for socialism, people will not voluntarily go towards that system. Now, they might voluntarily go towards it, but that system has to be created. People in their own natural state will engage in a market. And so through looking in the prism of whether private property should be owned or not owned is critical to understanding the American left. Because part of what the American left is trying to do today is take people's private property away. And you might say, oh, Charlie, come on, that's not true. You're on a limb here. Well, what do you think Medicare for All would do? It would nationalize 1/6 of the American economy, essentially taking people's private practices away, taking private hospitals away, taking doctors that might have their own best way of doing something, take that completely away and make them work for the federal government, make it a public good, essentially getting rid of the free enterprise, private property, essentially all the private property in our healthcare system. When Bernie Sanders says we should nationalize the fossil fuel industry, that's getting rid of private property. So these debates are still very much happening today. And so the left, based on the Marxist doctrine, looks through everything this way. It's the bourgeoisie versus the proletariat. The bourgeoisie versus the proletariat. The bourgeoisie is the ruling class, the evil capitalists, the business owners, and the proletariat. Those are the workers. And but they took this a step further, and the postmodernists did this in 1960. And again, we could do podcast after podcast after this, but the postmodernists, mostly by some French philosophers, which we can dive into at a later date, argued that the Marxist struggle is more than economic. It's oppressor versus oppressed, not just in economic terms, but also in sociological terms. So it's not just rich versus poor, but it's also white versus black. And it's also men versus women, and it's police versus citizens in this kind of power dynamic. And so the worst things that you can possibly be in America is white, male, old, and own a business. That all those things put you in a automatic oppressor class, despite you actually maybe never engaging in oppressorship. You might have owned a business and employed thousands of people and given money away to charity and been very equitable and very fair to so many different people. Despite all of that, the left immediately puts a label. They stereotype you, not perfectly, but they stereotype you immediately and put you and pigeonhole you into a corner, which is what I was trying to say. They pigeonhole you into a corner and they put a label on you with no understanding of who you are as an individual at all. And so we as conservative libertarians, we have guardrails of when we go too far. And in the 20th century, we learned a very important lesson, and we didn't learn a very important lesson. So first, let me tell you the very important lesson that we learned in the 20th century. We learned when anyone ever advances the evil and horrendous and vile idea of one race being more important or superior in a hierarchy than any other, that must be repudiated, reviled, and rebelled against instantaneously and immediately. We learned this lesson. I really believe we do. We did. We've learned it very well. In America, we have very little tolerance at all for racism. We are the least racist, multicultural, diverse country in the history of the world. The least racist. Are there individuals that are racist? Yes. Are we a racist country? Absolutely no. And so typically, unfortunately, and I think this is also incorrect because I think racism happens on both political sides. We as conservatives get mislabeled as racists far too often. And the media tries to say to us, they say, well, since there were very dangerous quote-unquote right-wing leaders in the last 100 years, you must do even more to essentially moderate your positions because you sound and look like something that is horrible and racist, despite being very little evidence around that. However, I'll tell you right here on the Charlie Kirk Show, whenever I encounter racism, I denounce it.
2016 Olympics, Brazil, Rio de Janeiro, the women's gymnastics team. The four members of the U.S. gymnastics team couldn't be ethnically different, more ethnically different. A black woman, a Hispanic woman, a Jewish woman, and a white woman. Every single one of those women we consider to be Americans and victors. You know what the Chinese gymnastics team looked like? They all look the same. You know what the Japanese gymnastics team looked like? They all look the same. You know what the Korean gymnastics team looked like? They all look the same. We are great because despite the melanin in your skin or where you come from, you come here, you believe in a core set of ideas, you are an American.
Can I give a quick example? All the best Winter Olympics, all the best Winter Olympics competitors were all European, though. All the best Winter Olympic competitors were all from Europe.
What?
All the top Olympic competitors were all from Europe. The winners and the gold
medalists.
Jesse
Owens was not from Europe.
Either Europe or European stock.
What?
Wait, well, you are verging on white nationalism, my friend. I want nothing to do
yeah,
with
that,
no nationalism
that.
Or anything like that.
We don't represent
that. I condemn,
that.
I disavow
Would it be better
completely.
If I said heritage?
And that is
I mean,
not
it's the
true.
Same thing.
Hold on a second. You don't understand what you just said, how ridiculous that is. Usain Bolt has European stock.
My bad. Not all of them. A majority.
No, you said that.
A majority. You're right.
No, you're wrong. I mean, you couldn't be more wrong. How about the U.S. men's basketball team? How many
said
white
winter,
people were
not
on
basketball.
That team?
I didn't say basketball. I said Winter Olympics.
You said Olympic.
I said Winter Olympics.
Well, I just want to make
I think we can all agree we disavow. Do we not disavow?
Right, this is, yeah, we don't support this. We don't support that.
If you encounter racism, banish him. And I bet you do. Because we as conservatives, we hold ourselves to higher standards than the left. We do this very, very well. And coming up in just a minute, I'm going to tell you the lesson we did not learn from the 20th century. But first, I'm a business owner. I know there's a lot of business owners out in the audience. I have this podcast. I have Turning Point USA. I don't own Turning Point USA, but I run it. And I could tell you, being an entrepreneur in today's times, one of the most important things for any entrepreneur is knowing your numbers, knowing your spreadsheets, knowing where the money's going payments, payroll, all that stuff. And I could tell you, until I found out about this system, it was so disorganized. I got one thing for payroll. I got one thing for expense reports. I got all these sorts of different tracking things. There was never a consolidated platform that put it all together, made it easy to use. But now there is, and now it is called NetSuite. You got to check this out. And again, for all of you business owners out there, you know it's too much time and too many resources, and that hurts the bottom line. So NetSuite by Oracle, the business management software that handles every aspect of your business in an easy-to-use cloud platform, gives you the ability and the visibility to control what you need to grow. With NetSuite, you save time, money, and unneeded headaches by managing sales, finance, accounting, orders, and HR instantly. Think about that. That's sales, finance, accounting, orders, HR. For me, that's like 9 different systems and 400 different passwords. Right now, it's all one different system called NetSuite right from your desktop or phone. That's why NetSuite is the world's number one cloud business system. And right now, NetSuite is offering you valuable insights with a free guide, 7 key strategies to grow your profits. You got to check this out. It's really impressive. NetSuite.com/Kirk. That's NetSuite.com/Kirk. NetSuite.com/Kirk to download your free guide, 7 key strategies to grow your profits. Thousands of the best-known brands and fastest-growing companies use NetSuite to manage their business, and now it's available to you. You'll learn how to optimize your business processes, drive operational excellence, sell across more channels, and much, much more. That's NetSuite.com/Kirk. Check out, use what I use, NetSuite.com/Kirk. And so the lesson that was learned from the 20th century is that anytime anyone dares to mention anything about racial superiority or racial hierarchy, that is an evil idea and that must be repudiated and it must be banished as far as possible. But what's the idea that wasn't learned in the 20th century? Well, without saying any names of any evil people, there were a couple experiments in racial hierarchy, and those are evil and they must be denounced completely and categorically. But there were also several experiments that tried equality of outcome. There were several experiments that tried to represent the proletariat against the bourgeoisie. And there were several experiments that tried to uproot prior history and to storm the Bastille and to take charge and take command over the status quo. We don't talk about those as much. I mean, did you know that in Mao's China, there were minimum 50 million people killed? Killed! That doesn't even count starvation or people that died early because of lack of nutrition. Did you know that there were anywhere between 20 to 30 million people killed in Stalin's Russia under the pursuit of equality of outcome? Or how about Pol Pot's experiment in Cambodia? Or what about the Korean communist disaster? Or what about Castro's Cuba? Or Mugabe's formerly Rhodesia, which turned into Zimbabwe? The idea of equality of outcome under the guise of socialism or communism was tried plenty of times. And so as you heard that sound, when somebody shows up to one of my events and dares talk about racial superiority and one race being better than other, I step up and I repudiate them and I kick them out immediately. And so when extreme ideology comes on the left, when it rears its head in a variety of different ways to erode private ownership of goods, or whether to try and destroy current institutions that are working, whether it be the nuclear family, or a constant assault on speech, where are the guardrails? Because we on the right have some very, very firm guardrails, some of which, most of which are self-regulated, and some of which the left regulates for us, some of which the left tries to find it when it actually doesn't exist within our own ranks. And we on the right, we conservatives, we libertarians, we learned a very big lesson. In fact, we learned both lessons in the 20th century. I mean, the lesson we learned is that anytime anyone tries to talk about racial superiority, you say, no, 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 that's not going to happen. But we also learned that communism and socialism are one of the most dangerous, one of the most disastrous ideas in the history of the world. The left has not learned this. And unfortunately, the left's focus, hyper-focus on race, what are they really trying to do? They're ignoring within their own ideology the failures of collectivism, the failures of autocrats exploiting other people under the guise of quote-unquote democratic socialism, and they're inciting fear around the widely accepted lesson that has been learned in the 20th century to try to make it seem as if we're much closer to the 1930s and 40s than we really are. This is why Bernie Sanders, he says, quote, "My father's whole family was wiped out by Hitler and his white nationalism. Too many people have fought over the years. Too many people have died against racism to let it resurface and flourish in America. We will go to war against white nationalism and racism in every aspect of our lives," he said, end quote. Look, I totally agree with Bernie Sanders. But does he also say, too many people have been wiped out by the idea of equality of outcome? Too many people have been wiped out under the idea of communism? And we will do everything we can to push back against that. No, instead, Bernie Sanders honeymooned in the Soviet Union. Instead, he thinks affectionately about socialist communist ideas. And even Joe Biden says, white folks are the reason we have institutional racism. White man Joe Biden says, continues, there has always been racism in America. White supremacists have always existed. They still exist. He added later that in his administration would, quote, not be tolerated. And this ties into the 1619 Project. So the New York Times, instead of talking about the true history of the United States, which is a history towards the pursuit of liberty and towards the equality of law, not the equality of outcome, they try to unnecessarily fearmonger and divide people around the idea that we have not progressed at all racially over the last 50 years. This is incorrect, and this is very dangerous. It actually fails to recognize the huge, the absolute improbable advancements that we have made racially in this country. And when I say 50 years, I mean since the Civil Rights era, but even the last 250 years. And so, but the New York Times needs to keep controversy going. Understand that the left always needs to have wedge issues to pit people against each other. Now, here's a great example. For 30 years, one of the biggest issues amongst the social liberals on the coast was gay marriage. They won gay marriage. Within minutes, they transitioned from the gay marriage debate to the transgender debate, as if they're moral equivalents. As if the gay marriage debate that two consenting adults should be able to get a certificate of a marriage license. If you all of a sudden are in support of that, you should also be in support of a man who thinks he is a woman should be able to compete against other women in high school sports. The left always needs perpetual division against people because that's how they get political power. Why do they want to spread this narrative? Political power and narcissistic gratification. And this is exactly why they continue this dishonest campaign to try to make it seem we are founded on racism. We are founded on liberty. We're not founded on racism. And it takes an intentional disinformation campaign to believe this sort of thing. And one of my favorite thinkers, Thomas Sowell, articulates this so well. He dismantles the left's obsession with dividing the world into oppressor versus oppressed. And look, for those that don't know who Thomas Sowell is, he's a brilliant economist. He's one of the greatest thinkers, and he was a disciple of Milton Friedman. And he happens to be black. And so I say all those things because I don't think of an individual first and foremost on their race. I think of them as who they are and their ethics and their character. The left thinks of people first and foremost as what victimized identity politic group can they neatly fit in to try to use them to assume more political power. Let's play the sound from the great Thomas Sowell, who's a fellow at the Hoover Institution.
Well, in 1960, which would be almost 100 years after the end of slavery, right, 22% of black kids grew up in homes with only one parent.
Just 22%?
Yes.
4 out of 5 were in homes with both parents?
Yes. 30 years later, after the liberal welfare state, that number had more than tripled. And so I say, well, let us compare, if we can speculate on how much that 22% was due to the legacy of slavery. But we know that that tripling was not due to the legacy of slavery. It was due to the legacy of a whole different set of policies.
So there's Thomas Sowell, who makes a very, very good point, and some would say, I mean, some in the academy would wrongly say he makes a very provocative point. But what Thomas Sowell is saying here is he's saying that the kind of the leftovers of slavery in the 1920s, if you will, the black single motherhood rate was around 22%. You actually extrapolate that all the way to the 50s and 60s, it stayed around 22%. Now, 22% is really high. I mean, that's really high. And we're not trying to make an excuse for that. But Thomas Sowell essentially says, okay, let's say that slavery was to blame for most of that and all the kind of systemic damage associated with it. But then all of a sudden, a total new set of policies were put in place in the 1960s. And so a new set of policies were actually incorporated. And I can tell you firsthand from people that actually lived in Chicago and they saw this happen, there were black communities after black communities, block after block, that had churches at the center, that had pastors in the community that were well revered, that and there were black fathers in almost every single home. And what happened is that through the federal government mandate, if you were below a certain income level, despite how close together your family was, they put you in these vertical housing units. Well, in the city of Chicago, one of those that was most popularized was Caprini Green. It's now shut down. Well, Caprini Green was a relocation center, essentially, for anybody in the south side of Chicago, regardless if they were in a two-parent house or not, to relocate it into a vertical housing center. And this literally extracted black families out of their homes. And Caprini Green got well known as one of the most dangerous, one of the most failed social government experiments in American history. It was so gang infested and so drug infested because over a long period of time, you took people out of their homes that they grew up in, you took them out of the communities that were functioning to some extent. And was the model absolutely perfect? Of course not. But blacks were actually getting much wealthier in the 1960s than people actually realized. That blacks were on pace to actually have a higher median income than whites that trend would have been allowed to continue in the 1960s and 1970s. But horribly racist policies put forth by Democrats to continue to control the black community, such as Caprini Green, were put into effect. And the biggest ones in particular were the subsidizing of single motherhood. And so it's the failed leftist ideas of the welfare state. So do not let anyone ever tell you that the leftist ideas have never been tried. Do you know we have spent over $20 trillion trying to abolish poverty in the black community over the last 50 or 60 years? And despite spending $20 trillion, the black community is poorer on average today than they were before it actually happened. And that's in today's dollars, just understanding what I'm saying, adjusted for inflation, $20 trillion. And so you look at the Caprini Green example. Caprini Green being about a 30-story building, all of a sudden the single motherhood rate skyrocketed from 22%, which was very high, to now well over 70%. Today in America, 70% now of black children born will not have a father in the household, and some of them will not even know their father altogether. Now, what this does over time is it breaks apart the community. It breaks apart the fabric of a functioning society. And so we as taxpayers, we subsidize single motherhood. And so if a black mother gets married, she loses her government welfare check. So, but let's actually take this a step further. How do we enforce that? Well, I mean, I actually asked a leftist. They say, well, you know, we have people that will go around and will enforce that, make sure that these are single mothers. I'll say, wait a second. we pay government bureaucrats to go knocking on doors to go make sure that single women are not getting married. Like single mothers are not getting married. Seriously? So we have our own enforcement bureau of our own government that makes sure that women in urban areas don't have a father in the home. So not only are we paying for it, we're paying for an additional salary of a government bureaucrat to make sure that someone doesn't get married, to make sure that the most timeless institution in American history does not actually exist, the family. The family is the singular institution that has stood the test of time. And look, Sol's second point is this, is that leaders around the world of the so-called lagging groups promote policies that are counterproductive and actually have the opposite effect of helping the community. Why is this? Because as Sol talks about, to the extent that those lagging communities assimilate into the values and accomplishments of the larger society, they no longer need those leaders. So essentially, this is a super academic way to say this. We'll play his sound in just a second. Al Sharpton would not have a job if the black community got rich. This is my that's my very simple way of saying the academic statement that Thomas Sowell just articulated. Al Sharpton and Jesse Jackson would not have millions and millions of dollars if the black community got self-reliant. That if the black community actually got richer, Al Sharpton and Jesse Jackson would be irrelevant. They have no skill set outside of exploiting people time and time again around fake scandals and fake boogeymen.
One of the things I discovered in the research for my book I'm currently working on is that leaders of groups that are lagging in countries around the world almost invariably have counterproductive policies for them. And it makes perfect sense because insofar as members of lagging groups assimilate into the values and achievements of the larger society, they don't need those leaders.
And Thomas Sowell does such an amazing job here because he talks about exploiting hurting people. And I'll tell you right now, every conservative listening to this program, we have an opportunity and we have an obligation to go after every single vote in the black community we possibly can. And Candace Owens has done an unbelievable job. She has blazed the trail. She deserves such credit. I'm honored to play a small role in assisting and helping her at Turning Point USA, TPUSA, to help her under this quest. Because I think there are so many conservatives in the black community. And so we went in the 1960s and bulldozed the porch houses. We bulldozed the communities that functioned. We bulldozed everything that worked in the black community and put them into vertical housing units, and we broke the back of the black family. And so look, but the left continues to spread this narrative because they're going towards hurting people. They're going towards people that are truly suffering. Now, under Donald Trump, they're suffering far less. The black poverty rate is all-time low. The black unemployment rate is at an all-time low. Latino unemployment rate is at an all-time low. But despite spending trillions and trillions of more dollars around these very dangerous and divisive ideas and trying to always play into this narrative of the oppressor versus the oppressed, why don't we use another O word, opportunity? Instead of talking about who is oppressing the black community, which of course is Democrats because there's Democrat city council and Democrat mayors and the Democrat party, why doesn't the conversation in the Democrat party and how about nationally and we as conservatives, libertarians, and Republicans should focus on this, on opportunity, on school choice, on entrepreneurship, on rebuilding the black family and all families? Those should be the three things that we should talk about every single day. And we at the Charlie Kirk Show try to talk about solutions. We try to talk about history, philosophy, economics, and solutions. So I'm going to give you three solutions right here at the Charlie Kirk Show, right here, right now. Number one, school choice for black kids, or school choice for all kids. If you go to a failing public school, you should have what's called a parent trigger. Your parent should be able to pull the trigger and put you into a functioning school. It should be that simple. There should be no controversy. There should be no discussion. You should be able to move to a better school. This will immediately create competition. It will create a pull against the bad schools. It will create a magnet towards the good schools, and you will have a real market in schools. We have a market in so many different things. Markets work. Second thing is entrepreneurship. We should empower people that have really good ideas. Small business loans, opportunity zones. Donald Trump has done a great job of this. Individuals that have good ideas should be empowered into these areas. The third thing, the most important thing, and we as Republicans, conservative libertarians, I'm not actually a self-identified Republican because I have such disagreements over what some of their stances over the last 20, 30 years. Despite my approval of Donald Trump, I'm a Republican after many other things. I'm a Christian. I'm an American. I'm a conservatarian. Then I'm a Republican. The thing that we should have at every rally, a sign that we should have all over the place, and I just don't see it, is three words. Rebuild the family. Rebuild the family. The left wants nothing to do with this. The left has destroyed the American family. Actually, at certain college campus courses, they believe that the family is a tool of the patriarchy. They believe the family is oppressive because the family, according to some people on the radical left, they believe that the family is a tool of exploitation and oppressorship. This is so incorrect. The family is one of the few things that has stood the test of time. The family is agnostic to religion. The family is agnostic towards, it should be agnostic to politics. These are three things. School choice, entrepreneurship, and the rebuilding of the American family. And I encourage all of you, and I'm telling you right now, that if we do not push back against this oppressor-oppressed argument, they are going to continue to pollute the minds of the American youth. And it's a very, very dangerous argument because it plays into victimology. It plays into pointing towards other people for your problems and not actually looking inwardly. It is such a dangerous consecutive chain of thinking. And if you are able to talk about school choice opportunity, entrepreneurship opportunity, and rebuilding the family opportunity, we will have so much success. I want to wrap up the show here with two quick things. First of all, I just got news that Senator Kirsten Gillibrand has dropped out of the presidential race. Oh, my goodness. What are we going to do without Senator Kirsten Gillibrand? She was basically giving away $30 t-shirts in exchange for a $1 contribution on her t-shirt. Mr. Producer's laughing right now because I always enjoyed my tweets going after Kirsten Gillibrand. But my pledge to you right here, right now on The Charlie Kirk Show is I will not stop attacking Kirsten Gillibrand for her hypocrisy, her mediocrity, and her bad ideas just because she stopped running for the president of the United States. You are welcome because she is so mistaken. She's constantly wrong and she is never in doubt. I use that to describe a lot of the Democrats, but I think that is just such an accurate depiction of Kirsten Gillibrand. She's spread bad economics, especially when it came to the United States women's soccer team. Here's the real question, Mr. Producer. Where is her 0% going to go to? Who's going to win her 0%? Where is her 0% of support going to transfer to? Now, you're going to hear a lot of these arguments over the next six months. Over the next 6 months, you're going to say, oh, this person dropped out. Where are their support going to go to? Well, where's her 0% going to go to? Well, I don't know. I think Joe Biden's pretty happy because her 0% of supporters might actually transfer to Joe Biden. So Kirsten Gillibrand, you will not be missed from the American political narrative. Good luck continuing to wreck our country in the United States Senate. But I want to finish with this because I'm getting so much. I'm going to do a whole podcast episode on the economy and on the recession next week. So I'm going to forecast it. And we covered a lot in this episode. And I love doing this and I appreciate it. A lot of this is based on your feedback. So right now, please go give your reviews on the Apple podcast and just say what you think and how you feel, topics you want me to cover, because we listen to those and we have feedback on them. And the reason we did this is people say, hey, Charlie, what motivates the left? Talk about 1619. Please do this. And so that's exactly why we did what we did here. So please give us those 5-star ratings. Hit subscribe. But I'm getting so much feedback about the recession. Charlie, are we going to recession? Or are we not going to recession? And so this is the final kind of segment that I'm going to do here, and I want to kind of finish on this. And here's what it is. First of all, we have to realize that there is no such thing as the economy. You may say, what are you talking about, Charlie? Of course there is. There's no such thing as the economy. The economy does not exist. The economy is nothing more than trillions and trillions of input of human action put into one of something that we quote unquote call the economy. The economy is nothing more than the aggregate of unlimited amounts of piece of data that we put together. And actually, I don't think we use the best metrics to actually gauge economic growth and economic success. I think GDP is highly deceiving at times. GDP counts government spending as one of the inputs. I think consumer confidence is actually a really good metric, which, by the way, consumer confidence in this present economic situation rose to 177.2, the highest level in 19 years. I think unemployment is pretty good, but you also have to talk about labor force participation. But if you use unemployment, it's at a generation low at 3.7%. Look, a recession, all that means is you have a certain level of slowdown of economic growth. And here's the one thing. Since an economy is the input of trillions and trillions of data points and trillions of decisions of human beings put into one thing that we call the economy is not like a place you can visit. It's not a place you can have a selfie with. The economy is not like a machine. We like to think of it like that, but it's really not. The economy is just like telling the weather, essentially. It's like, here's what is happening at this point, at this time, of what human beings are doing. And that's a really important thing to remember, because we think we can plan the economy, we think we can command the economy, and we really can't. All we can really do is tinker around the edges. And the two biggest kind of gauges, and again, I'm going to do a whole podcast on this, is monetary policy and fiscal policy. Monetary actually matters a lot more. The money supply, and I think we've played games with our money supply way too much over the last 30, 40 years. All my libertarians listening to this are probably like cheering, yay, go Charlie, he's talking about monetary policy, we love you. I love you too, gold standard people. We'll do a whole episode on that at one point, because I think our funny money system is something that will long term really create a lot of economic anxiety for a lot of different people. But look, when it comes to a recession, if you look at just the data alone, I do not believe we're headed towards a recession. But since we're talking about human action, we're talking about human beings, essentially the economy and how we judge it as a recession, we can convince ourselves into a recession. Tomorrow, if we wanted to go into a recession, we might. If enough people stop shopping, if enough people stop going out to eat, and enough people stop essentially acting a certain way, a recession will happen. And guess what? What is the greatest way that human beings actually, what is the most predictable way that human beings act based on the information that they process, based on the radio shows they listen to and the TV shows that they watch? And so there's enough drama around the idea of a recession, then you can convince yourself into a recession. You can create a recession, which I believe most of the American left actually wants to create a recession. Play sound right now of Bill Maher saying he wishes he had a recession.
I feel like the bottom has to fall out at some point. And by the way, I'm hoping for it, because I think one way you get rid of Trump is a crashing economy. Yeah. So please bring on the recession. Yeah. Sorry if that hurts people, but...
Exactly. Bill Maher hates Donald Trump so much. He hates Donald Trump so much that he wants misery over what is right for the country. And that is wrong, and that is evil, and that is incorrect. And there are so many economic metrics right now. The Dow Jones has hit over 80 record highs during the Trump administration, topping 26,000 for the first time ever. The July jobs report beat expectations, 164,000 jobs added, 16,000 were manufacturing jobs, and we have 17 months straight of unemployment below 4%. But make no mistake, the left might be able to convince itself into a recession. However, don't believe the garbage, don't believe the nonsense. Continue to act in a rational, ethical, and logical way outside of the noise of the propagandists on the news media, and that alone will be able to tell you the best indicator of what the quote-unquote economy actually will do. The economy is nothing more than your life and your decisions. We'll go back to the original point that I made at the beginning, that we are not a collective, first and foremost. We are a group of individuals. You and you alone will be able to make the best decisions that you can see fit for your life, your family, and your future. And coming up in the next episode next week, we're going to talk a lot more about economics. I think I've not talked to all of you about economics, and don't. It's not a snooze fest. Trust me, you are going to love it. I'm going to make economics make sense. We're going to go into interest rates. We're going to go into the money supply. We're going to go to the history of all those different things. And you will walk away listening to the Charlie Kirk Show. Next episode, we do smarter, better informed, and more convicted to take on the left than ever before, because they do not understand economics. Because the first law of economics is you must understand that there is scarcity resource. And the first law of the left is you ignore the first law of economics. You do not believe that there are scarcity resources. You only believe in the defiance of the first rule of economics. This has been a great episode, everybody. Thank you so much for your feedback. Please give us 5-star rating. Leave us a review. We'd love it. Go to charliekirk.com for more updates, or tpusa.com if you want to get involved with Turning Point USA. We love to hear from all of you, and we'd love to get you engaged and involved as this college semester is starting. Get involved at tpusa.com. That's tpusa.com. If you can donate some money, that helps us a lot, or get involved, start a chapter. We want you to come to our events. Thank you guys so much. Please get one friend to subscribe to the Charlie Kirk Show. I'm asking you, please, get one friend to subscribe to the show and give a 5-star rating. Leave a review. If you leave a review, we love those reviews. We listen to them. We internalize them. On behalf of our whole team here at the home of rational, conservative, libertarian thinking, we thank you for your feedback, your patriotism, your involvement. Stay involved. Check out Turning Point USA, tpusa.com. Thank you guys so much. Signing off to the next edition of the Charlie Kirk Show.
Hey, everybody, it's Laura Ingraham, and I'd like to invite you to check out my new show, The Laura Ingraham Podcast, exclusively on Podcast One. So join me 3 days a week as I cover politics, the culture, everything in between, laugh, learn, all at the same time. We got you locked and loaded, and you'll be ready for the week, ready for the month. And it's very easy. You just subscribe today, download new episodes exclusively at podcastone.com or wherever you find your favorite podcast. And you know mine's going to be one of your newest.